Disasters and emergencies happen to good people like you every day. The frequency of these events are increasing at an astonishing rate. Now is the time to take responsibility for preparing and empowering yourself for the inevitable. Welcome to the Survive University Podcast, where we provide an education in preparation, giving you the tools to get ready, be ready, and stay ready. Now, let's get on with today's
lesson. Listen up, my preps. Welcome to another episode of the Survive University Podcast, where we discuss research-based solutions focused on preparation for protecting your life and your health during an emergency or disaster. Our topics cover all things survival as we discuss with industry professionals on how to help you triumph over the toughest times in your life. I'm your host, Hakeem Isler, with co-host Main J, the OG, aka the Ordinary Guy. On today's episode, we have a really good friend of mine, Steve DeLellis. He is recently retired as a colonel after 36 years of decorated service in the highest tiers of the military elite forces, such as Rangers, Special Forces, and the legendary Delta Force. He has been involved in many combat missions around the world, including the well-known Somalia mission that the movie Black Hawk Down is based on. He has so many accolades that it would take too long to listen to them all. However, since he's with us today, I'll let him say more about his background. So without further ado, here's my good friend and American hero, Steve DeLellis.
Yeah, thanks, Hakeem, and thanks, OG. It's a real pleasure to be here, and I really enjoy what you're doing, Hakeem. The podcast and all your classes, undoubtedly help those that don't really understand what evil situations can look like and how to deal with them and how to persevere through them. So I'm happy to be here, and I really am humbled by the fact that you asked me to join you today. So. Yeah, I spent 36 years in the Army. I spent 31 of those here at Fort Bragg in North Carolina. I spent just about all of those years in the special operations community. I spent time in the Rangers. I spent time in the Special Forces. I spent about 20 years in the Army Special Missions Unit, otherwise known as Delta Force. I spent 10 of those years as an operator. Engaged in all kinds of conflicts all around the world. I went back to school about halfway through my career, about not quite 20 years into my career, and became a physician assistant and turned right back around and spent 19 more years in special operations units, taking care of my former teammates and the operators and the warfighters that came after me. So I'm pretty comfortable in the Fort Bragg community and pretty comfortable with the special operations community in the Army. I've spent six conflicts around the globe, I think a total of 16 rotations to various and sundry places like Just Cause in Panama and Mogadishu, Somalia, Haiti, the Balkan conflict, obviously lots of time in the desert, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan. So I'll pause there.
Awesome.
And that's a wrap.
And that's a wrap. That's it.
Nothing else to say.
So let's lead into this because, you know, Survive University is about really giving, you know, people of all different walks of life an understanding of what it takes to survive different hardships in their life. And I think, Nowhere are the different hardships more evident than living a military lifestyle. You know, when you are a soldier and you have family and your family has to be home and then you have soldier duties and you have family duties. And, you know, as you grow in the military, I'm sure you go into different walks of life. So it's a lot of different hardship. And so I think it's great to have you on the show because you've seen the full spectrum. I mean, not only in your own personal life, but you've seen so many soldiers that have come under you. I think, what, you retire as a colonel, am I correct?
I did. So,
yeah, and at 36 years, you've done and seen some amazing people come through. So you've seen it all, basically. And one of the things that I think that's really amazing about you, though, is that when I first met you, I thought you were just this ordinary guy, right? I knew you had been in the military, but I just thought you were an ordinary military guy. And I remember there was a sergeant major I was talking to, an SF, a special forces sergeant major, and you came in one day and he knew who you were and you left. And he's like, "You know who that guy is?" And I was like, "Yeah, that's Steve." And he's like, no. "Do you know who he is?" I was like, "It's Steve." He's like, "No." And he proceeded to tell me a few things. And I was just like blown away. But that's what makes you so special. But, you know, I'm sure you would say that you know quite a few people like that. But I know you. And it really speaks to my life. But I think a lot of people sometimes get into this phase that, hey, Steve is not a normal human being, you know, and they will separate you from just an everyday human. And I think having someone like you on to maybe talk to the fact that, you know, that you are real, that you are a real person, the hardships you went through and how you persevered can maybe help other people. But first humanizing you in the sense that, you know, you are a G.I. Joe, but you're not a G.I. Joe. You know, the toy that you buy on the shelf doesn't have, you know, feelings and have to deal with all that stuff. And so would you mind talking a little bit about that?
No, not at all. And I think you hit on a couple of really important points. So, you know, we have the benefit of you knowing my family. Both my children have trained with you doing Toshindo. My son has accomplished his second black belt under your tutelage. And my daughter had worked her way about halfway through her black belt before she had turned a path and moved on to running track and cross country and other things that really took up her time. And, you know, my wife, you know, I have a wife and two kids and we have a world that goes on outside of the military, but you're right that so much of my life, raising those kids, happened in absentia. You know, I was gone for so many years. I literally left for, I believe it was Iraq, when Zach was 10 days old. My son was 10 days old when I left for Iraq. And then, you know, continued to deploy many times throughout the year, like I said, 16 times, and spent almost 5 years boots on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan, meaning that I missed five very important years of my kids' lives. And people like you and other friends in the community are partly responsible for helping me and my wife raise our children. And we look for role models that that shared our beliefs and our way of life, our lifestyle, and you know, people with integrity and a work ethic, and that was really important to me to know that the kids had structure in their life, and my wife had spent so much time and energy ensuring that what the kids did while I was gone was positive and fruitful and meaningful, and. You know, unlike a lot of guys that can pull the wool over their wives' eyes, I don't really have that benefit. My wife also grew up in the special operations community. My wife also spent time in the Army Special Missions Unit. There was no such thing as, "Honey, I can't tell you that," because she knew that, whatever that was. So, you know, the kids like to bust on me every now and then when I mess something up or I make a mistake. They, big tough operator, you got that one wrong, didn't you? Right. there is reality. There is realism in our lives. It's not a make-believe life. There's not a big curtain that I can go hide behind and say, "Oh, that's my military side. You know, you're not welcome in there." Because my wife and my kids knew exactly what I did and when I did it and how I did it. And sometimes that's challenging, especially back in my enlisted days when I was an operator. I mean, I was an operator in a very serious unit that had very serious missions with serious consequences. And, you know, you have to teach your kids that, the hard right is sometimes what we need to be doing. And, That's the life of an American soldier or airman or Marine or sailor. You know, sometimes our work does fly in the face of what traditional beliefs are. And that's hard sometimes, but you have to explain to the kids that we do everything we do because we know what we're doing is right. And we're working to protect others and to help others that are in bad situations.
Well, Steve, I want to jump in just because you bring up a good point. We on this podcast, I balance myself as being the ordinary guy, and everyone that I've met through Hakeem has an extraordinary experience, yourself included. It seems like everyone has this defining moment in their life, which defines their relationship to how people see them. With Hakeem, when I first met him, I was like, okay, it was like fifth degree black belt ninja. Okay, that's what stuck in my head. And then everything else was formulated around that. For you, when Hakeem talked about you as possibly being someone we can speak to for the podcast, it was like, okay, do you know Steve? And I was like, nope. And he said, Black Hawk Down. And it's like, okay. And from that point, I started backtracking to learn more about who you were based on that one solid experience. But I know that a person is a combination of a lot of experiences, yourself included. So if we could do something, I want to step back a little bit and find out a little bit about who you are or who you were before you got into the military. Learn more about what made you become interested in the military. For those individuals who are listening, who hear you and they're like, okay, Black Hawk Down, it's a big leap from high school senior to Black Hawk Down. Everything that goes on in between, who were you before this infamous incident that everyone knows you for?
So I think I had a pretty cool childhood. I grew up in New York and New Jersey. When I was about 12 years old, my family moved to Louisville, Kentucky. And I went to school in Louisville. I graduated from high school in Louisville, Kentucky. And my senior year of high school, I tell people my parents moved away from home. So my dad was transferred to Houston, Texas. My older brother, a year older than me, was about to become a freshman at the University of Louisville while I was moving into my senior year. And we actually convinced my parents to let me stay in Louisville with my older brother. So he went off to be a freshman in college, and I did my senior year of high school virtually without parents, which is kind of cool. I don't think we could pull that off today. I think the school system is far too wise to let that happen. But yeah, so it was tough early on. You know, we had to, my brother and I worked, we both had jobs, we both were going to school, we both had to perform because we couldn't let the cat out of the bag. You know, if I was getting in trouble and not getting good grades, certainly there would be phone calls to parents that weren't there. And that would cause all kinds of eyebrows to be raised. So it wasn't easy. I mean, my dad helped pay for our college, but we had to pay for, you know, our rent and gas and clothes and food and stuff like that, like everyone else does. And so we were working and going to school. And I took a lot of classes very early on. My goal was to go to medical school. And so I front loaded as many classes as I could very early on, and ultimately ended up burning myself out. I took a lot of classes and worked a lot of hours, and got to the point where, you know, there was a summer where I just decided I need to go blow off some steam. And I had some buddies that, I would go work at a resort, during our summers in high school. And I decided, you know what, I'm just going to take a year off and go earn some money and come back and be better prepared to go off to medical school. Well, I spent a whole year in Vail, Colorado, and came back without a whole lot to show for it, except a lot of climbing experience. We were, avid rock climbers and ice climbers. And, we did a lot of rock and ice climbing, during that year. And, came home broke and thought, man, this isn't working out real well for me. So I just sort of decided to try the Army. I had some friends that had a special operations background, and I knew a little bit about the special forces, not enough to really make an intelligent decision as a you know, fresh out of high school, young college kid. But I went to the recruiter's office one day and said, I want to join the special forces. And of course, they tried to talk me out of it. You know, there's so many other things you can do. Why would you want to do that? You know, that's dirty hard work. And that made me want to do it even more. When someone tells me I can't do something, it's really, you know, that becomes the challenge, especially someone of authority. So I joined the Army on an unassigned Special Forces enlistment. And I was very fortunate. Two of my drill sergeants in basic training were Vietnam veterans that were assigned to Ranger companies. And they pulled all of us that were unassigned Special Forces aside about halfway through basic training and said, hey, you guys are all going to SF, but you know, you might want to consider going to the Rangers. It's probably a better place for a young soldier to learn the skills and the ropes as a soldier, and then you can always go to Special Forces after joining the Rangers. So like the Special Forces, I didn't know anything about the Rangers either, but it sounded pretty cool. And coming from two you know, Vietnam veteran Rangers, probably couldn't have had a better introduction to what the Rangers were all about. So I agreed. I signed up to change my contract and ended up in the 1st Ranger Battalion in Savannah, Georgia. And that was the beginning of my career. And I didn't plan on staying very long. You know, I joke sometimes that I joined the Army for college money. I'm not really sure that's what I did. I mean, I think in the back of my mind, that was the plan. But I think I joined the Army to get away from, you know, the high stress environment I was in, even though I was successful and ready to move on to school. You know, this new lifestyle I found with the Army Rangers was really cool. And I really enjoyed the training and I excelled. I got promoted very fast. I just enjoyed what I was doing. So I'll pause there. I think that's a stepping stone, at least to the start for you.
No, I sincerely appreciate that. Cause in, I used to work in the film industry, and what you would get if this was a movie was you being somewhere in Louisville and then seeing, the Uncle Sam poster and you deciding right then and there, you want to go in, and next thing you know, it's, you know, Black Hawk Down, you know? So hearing that there is some context and there's some, I guess, thinking and contemplating when moving forward with making this decision and some uncertainty really adds a layer of, I guess, clarity to where you've been, because we see the final destination. You're very accomplished. But like I stated before, for those young individuals or like me, the ordinary guy, I'm a little too long in the tooth to enlist. But it's good to know that, OK, somebody can accomplish what you've accomplished, starting off on a path of uncertainty. But as long as you keep moving forward, you're good to go. Good stuff.
Yeah, I love that. You know, you've taken this time to move from being the Wizard of Oz to us recognizing that you're just a guy that was behind the curtain, right? And you're a human being like the rest of us. So that's beautiful. You know, you've just kind of skimmed over the top of it. There's a lot of hardship that goes into infantry basic training, into Ranger school, which is very difficult, into then following up that with SF, and then following up that with Delta. Delta wasn't created until 1977 or somewhere around there. And then you probably went in like 88. So, I mean, it only been in operation for 10 years. And those first few years, there were things, you know, I wasn't in there, so I don't know. But there were things going on, but it was still figuring itself out, from what I understand, in those early years. Separating itself, a lot of people didn't really understand what it was about and, you know, what was supposed to be done. At least that's, again, from my baby point of view from the outside. But, you know, what do you think that was in you that made those things possible? Did you just have the mindset for it?
I think that's fair. I did a lot of running, both in high school and in college. I ran track, I pole vaulted. I liked the adrenaline of, you know, those events, and did a lot of rock climbing as a kid. You know, we were always backpacking or climbing somewhere, every every 4-day weekend or holiday, you know, as kids, we were hitchhiking to the Red River Gorge in Eastern Kentucky, or the Smoky Mountains, or the Rocky Mountains, or anywhere in between where we could get our climbing adrenaline on. And you know, there were connections to all those things I enjoyed doing in the Rangers. So, you know, basic training to me was a game. It wasn't, I was a little older. I wasn't, you know, fresh out of high school like a lot of kids. I'd been in college a couple of years. So to me, I had the ability to step back and just kind of analyze what was going on. And you could see that, you know, if you played the game, you succeeded. And if you didn't, and you bucked the system, well, you were ejected, or you failed miserably time and time again, and your life was miserable. So basic training and airborne school, which is how everyone in that path started, was really pretty simple. You know, it was however long basic training was. I don't even remember. I'm willing to bet, Hakeem, you don't even remember how long basic training was.
I think infantry was like 11 weeks.
We did basic training and infantry advanced individual training, and then right off to Ranger school. And then because I signed that Ranger contract, right into the Ranger indoctrination program. So there was a period of about a year where it was just nonstop, you know, pass through gate after gate after gate. And again, I just looked at each one of those gates as a game. It was just something you had to do and sit back and be the gray man, you know, excel when you had to excel, but don't stand out when you didn't need to stand out, and certainly don't screw up. And I was very fortunate. You know, a lot of guys got hurt in basic training in AIT. A lot of guys got hurt in airborne school, and I made it through just fine. I made it through the Ranger indoctrination program just fine. The first Ranger battalion. So when I went through the Ranger indoctrination program, there was not a Ranger regiment. There were only two Ranger battalions. There was the first Ranger battalion in Savannah, Georgia, and the second Ranger battalion in Fort Lewis, Washington. And it wasn't for a couple of years until a couple of years after I had made it into the first Ranger battalion that the Ranger regiment was created. I don't want to risk sounding crass or throwing innuendos around, but the two Ranger battalions really considered themselves the cream of the crop of the Army. You know, we didn't have necessarily a higher headquarters as in the Ranger Regiment when it finally came online, but we had administrative commands. The 1st Ranger Battalion was controlled by the 24th Infantry Division, which no longer exists. And the 2nd Ranger Battalion was controlled, I believe, by the 7th or the 9th Infantry Division at Fort Lewis, Washington, which doesn't exist anymore. And we were kind of those rogue children. You know, we were these, you know, the infantry units that we fell under administrative control of were the conventional military. They were the guys that fought these big, you know, face-to-face engagements where the Rangers were always sneaking around behind enemy lines. And that's the kind of stuff that really excited me. And we excelled at that. And the opportunities when the two Ranger battalions got together before there was a regiment really gave us an opportunity to shine. You know, there was always a competition between 1st and 2nd battalion. And that really enhanced that military experience for me as a young non-commissioned officer. You know, you can take your team and your squad and go out there and really do good things and show your capabilities. So really, I think it was early on in my career, I didn't look at it as a challenge. I looked at it as just playing the game, you know, figuring the game out and playing the game to succeed.
I think that's real interesting. And then I'm going to pass it over to Maine, because I remember talking to an SF guy while I was in, and he was doing, you know, some stuff. And he was saying to me, he was talking about some other special operations forces groups, and he kind of made mention like, oh, you know, well, these guys are a bunch of, you know, hippies, and they don't know and they just want to do what they want, and they don't have any discipline, and so on and so forth. And and I was just like, you know, and I remember thinking like the level of discipline that when you talk about, let's say, like, even if you take that and take it out of a military context and you think about rock climbers and you think about hikers and backpackers and things of that nature, quite often tagged to those groups is that kind of hippie-ish, you know, thought of like, oh, they just like hanging out and, you know, drinking and like climbing stuff. So when you take that persona and then you talk about, you know, that's where, you know, not saying you were hippie, but saying that, you know, you love climbing, you love being in these groups and doing all these things. But then you go into these very regimented, strict, you know, organizations. Like, how did that not conflict?
Yeah, you know, that's a great point and a great segue. You know, the Rangers had received many accolades for assaulting Point de Hoc and scaling the sea cliffs at Point de Hoc to you know, destroy the big German guns that were part of their defensive positions. And so the Rangers were known for climbing. My opportunity came very early on in the first Ranger Battalion when I was asked if I wanted to join the assault climber team, and I did. And after the first year, I was asked if I wanted to lead the assault climber team in the first Ranger Battalion, and I did. And for a couple of years, I helped run the assault climber course, which was really neat. So here I am, a rock climber backpacker in the civilian world. Now I'm getting paid to be essentially a backpacker and a climber in the military world, although I have to carry a gun everywhere I go, right? But I'm doing it with a bunch of very disciplined, very, very well, very fit guys that just happen to have another mission at the top of the cliff or the end of the hike, whatever it may be. So it was not a hard transition, really, when you think about it. I mean, going from carrying a backpack around as a civilian kid and rock climbing to carrying a backpack around and rock climbing as a military guy was really a pretty neat opportunity for me.
Hey guys, are you feeling overwhelmed? I know I am. There is a lot of information here for us to take in. So we ask all of our guests at the end of the show to give us some valuable lessons that we can practice and work on. You'll find that information on our Patreon account, where we would like to invite you to come over for $4 a month. You can join our Patreon account. You can help support us, keep us doing this good work, and then also learn some valuable skills. If you're looking to get more education, get into some courses, join us at our SurviveUniversity.com website. Again, that's SurviveUniversity.com, where you can gain the knowledge that you need to really grow your survival expertise. So really, I think that's unfair then, that kind of assessment is like being like lazy or a hippie, because really, when you really understand what a rock climber does and the discipline it takes to do that on your own or to really enjoy that. And a hiker, I mean, you have to like pack your bag correctly. You have to have your route selected. You have to do all these things. So it's really not, you know, very, you know, ad hoc. It's very structured in some ways, you know.
We prided ourselves on learning how to navigate as kids. You know, I could read a map and use a compass at a very young age. We had no problem setting off in the mountains. Like I said, we would hitchhike to the Smoky Mountains every opportunity we had. And wherever we got dropped off is where we got dropped off. And we would make the best of it. We whip out the map and the compass and figure out where we were and where we needed to be. And we'd head in whatever direction we wanted to go for whatever length of time we wanted to be there. The same held true in my military experience. You know, getting to the military and knowing how to read a map and use a compass was, again, put me probably a few years ahead of my peers. And, you know, back in those days, Hakeem, you remember, there was no GPS. I was actually part of one of the teams that evaluated the very first GPS, and it was massive. It was about the size of a small TV, you know, or the old boom boxes you can remember. I mean, this thing was this big, you know, and, you know, it added another 50 pounds to the top of your rucksack. And I was like, the hell with this. I mean, I can read map and compass just fine. And you know what? It doesn't take batteries. And I know exactly where I am. So, and of course, now everyone's got one on their watch and on their phone, and you know, they're a whole lot more capable. But still, you get into a position where someone's jamming your signal, or you know, one of our peer or near peer enemies starts jamming our satellites, then we're going right back to map and compass. And I'm afraid there's not a lot of leaders out there that know how to use a map and compass in our military.
Actually, that's a good point. I want to step back a little bit and say, in regards to, it looks like from what I'm hearing, like I said, I'm the ordinary guy. It was also your perspective on things was also a benefit to you, because you have another person who had that kind of experience in their childhood. But when they get into the military structure and the fact that they have to do it, it's not based on the fact that they want to do it, becomes an obstacle for them to overcome. But you took everything on and saying, well, I already know how to do this. This is just going to build to my skill set that I had from when I was a kid. So I think perspective comes into that a large part. But what I was going to ask you, and I don't want to make it sound like you had everything easy, but it seemed like you had a grasp, a firm grasp on things to a certain point throughout your life, as far as even though when you were unclear as to where to go, you knew you were able to evaluate your options and proceed accordingly. What part of your life did you face when you hit a, I don't want to say a wall, but you hit an obstacle that wasn't so clear to overcome based on your past experience?
I think that's a great question. And I'd have to go right back to those days on the streets of Louisville, Kentucky, because my roommate was my older brother. And when I told him I had visited the recruiter, he just shook his head. He's like, yeah, whatever. You know, I think like most of my friends, my brother thought, you know, you're the last guy to go in the military. My dad was an immigrant. My dad came to the States from Italy when he was 26 years old. My mom was born to Czechoslovakian parents. Our family wasn't deeply rooted in American tradition and American military service. It wasn't just like, you know, you followed the footsteps of your father, your grandfather, your uncle, you know, whatever. So it was very odd, I think, for my brother to hear me say, I went and talked to the recruiter. But not just talk to the recruiter, I actually signed a contract with the recruiter. I'm joining the Army. And he's like, you're nuts, man. You know, and he drove me to the MEP station on a very cold day in November of 1983 and said, I can't believe you're doing this, but have fun, you know, and off I went. So, and I don't know that it was a plan, OG. I don't know that that was a plan. I think it was a Hail Mary. It was a, man, what am I going to do at this point in time? And that just sounded like the thing to do at the time. It wasn't based on any preconceived notion of military, hearing from uncles or fathers or grandfathers. It was just a thing. And I think, you know, I think there are probably a lot of kids in America that do just that. You know, I mean, you drive through middle America, you drive through rural America, and, you know, there are billboards everywhere. See the world, right? Join the Navy, see the world, right? Well, I knew I wasn't joining the Navy. There was no way in hell I would. And I had already seen a pretty good bit of this country anyway, not necessarily the world, but certainly this country. I'd been to a lot of states as a kid. And I really appreciated the fact that I had an opportunity to go do something and at least try it, you know, at least try the military, and knew that if nothing else, I would end up with some college money at the end of whatever experience I had, and maybe a little bit of discipline.
36 years later.
Still trying to get the college money.
Yeah.
So that, I love that aspect of it. So let's say, because we're coming close on this time lot. This time slot. So I want to make sure that there's some other things that I want to get to. But I did want to ask you, if you're looking back at that first half of your military career and you say there's a lesson here that I need to tell ordinary people about how they can set up their life to take it to the next level, or there's something in this story that I would share with my son as I'm saying, hey, son, you know, this is the cream of the, this is what you need to know. What can you give me anything off the top of your head that would kind of.
Absolutely. Choose your mentors wisely. You know, I had mentioned the two drill sergeants at basic training that were both Vietnam era Rangers. Those two guys, I can't thank them enough for the recommendation they gave me. I don't think the Special Forces would have been, the wrong place to start, but, Special Forces is traditionally an organization of non-commissioned officers. And I was not at the time a non-commissioned officer. I was a private. The Rangers, it was a much better place for a young soldier without any military experience to start. It gave me a great foundation to start my military career. But more importantly, I think I had the opportunity to watch some of my leaders, the leadership in my unit as a Ranger, grow and succeed as non-commissioned officers and officers. And I watched what they did next. So everyone in my chain of command, my team leader, my squad leader, my platoon sergeant, my platoon leader, they all went to selection for the Army Special Missions Unit. They all went to Delta and all succeeded. And I thought, that sounds like a reasonable next step. So I followed in their footsteps because I knew that they were solid soldiers. I knew that they were stand-up guys. I knew that they were not, this was not the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. They were good guys. They were hard soldiers, but they were real people. And, if they could do it, I could do it too. And it just made sense to me that that was the next reasonable step in my career. So I had the wonderful opportunity to follow really good mentors throughout my military career. And that was very important in achieving the success I achieved.
So finding good mentors is a kernel or a golden seed or a golden nugget that I can take with me moving forward. I've heard that, and I try to do that in my personal life also. At what point did you find out that you became the mentor?
I think it's probably 2 years after I retired. So that was about 6 months ago. I had a real enlightening experience probably about 15 years into my career. So I was a senior non-commissioned officer at the time. And I was at the PX on Fort Bragg, the store that sells stuff, uniform stuff that you put on your uniform and the like. And I had walked out of the PX, and I ran into a former soldier of mine from the Ranger Battalion that I had fired, a guy that just, couldn't cut the mustard. He just wasn't the right material to be there. I didn't recognize him, but he came up to me and he said, "Sergeant DeLellis." I said, "Yeah." And I kind of recognized him, and he told me who he was. And he said, "I hated you. I wanted to kill you when you were my leader." Mm-hmm. I said, "Really? But you didn't." He said, "No, I didn't. And it's because of you I am where I am right now." And he had several stripes on his collar as well. He had become a sergeant. He had achieved some level of success in wherever he went after I had to fire him from the Rangers. And while he probably hated me for firing him from the Rangers, what he was able to accomplish at his next organization was probably based on some tough lessons learned from his previous encounters. So that was a telltale moment for me. And ever since then, when I walk out of the PX, I always look around to see who's about to shoot me or kill me. So I pay attention to the danger spots now.
Wow. Okay. So now let's spend some time on something that I think most people know. And that's why we bring it up, because other military things people don't know, but you joined the unit, you joined Delta. And that also is very, there's some meat there. When I meet you, the Steve DeLellis I know, when I think about the person who has to go, a friend of mine said it best. He says, everyone's afraid of the boogeyman. And he was a SWAT operator. And so it was just this highlighted moment that, we work to be a certain characteristic when we have to do a certain job. And to be on an assault team, you have to be a different person when you go in those scenarios. So one is, how did you go from backpacker, hiker, I want to be a medical physician that's going to help heal people, to someone who moved to a level of, oh, you know, if I get this mission, there are things that I have to do that go against, or maybe not be that, you know, in the same vein as that, that medical healer, you know, at that particular time.
Yeah. So before I answer that question, I want to go back to a very important point you made just a second ago, talking about the boogeyman. And this wouldn't be so relevant if you didn't know my son. So very early on in Zach's life, I taught Zach to never be afraid of the dark. Don't be afraid of the boogeyman, because Zach, you are the boogeyman. You can become the boogeyman, right? And it's the fear of the unknown. It's the fear of the dark. You know, it drives me nuts when I watch people like walking on the beach with their cell phone flashlight out. Like, what do you think you're going to step on or see? It's the beach, for crying out loud, right? You know, I always loved the dark. I taught my kids to never be afraid of the dark, because if you know how to use the dark to your advantage, you'll always be in control. So I taught Zach very early on to never fear the boogeyman, because he was the boogeyman. And I guarantee if you ask Zach that today, he'll mention that somehow or agree with me. And Akeem, again, being a veteran of the special operations community, you know this. But I'll explain it anyway. So one of the beauties of the special operations community, especially as you ascend the rung of the special operations community, and certainly being in a tier one unit, being in the special missions unit for the Army, this is absolutely the pinnacle of what I'm about to say, is, and that is, before you go into an operational environment, you isolate and you learn everything about that operational environment you could possibly know. You know who the players are, you know what the problem is, you know what the conflict is, you know what the pitfalls are, you know what contingencies you need to plan for. So it's not the same as being just a young soldier that's being told, stand here and face that direction, and if anyone comes, shoot them. That's not the case in the special operations community. The tier one units like Delta and SEAL Team 6 are laser focused on whatever their target is. And in my opinion, those targets are like cancers. They're cancers of whatever society they're in. They are the tumor of that society. And, you know, you can think of us as the chemotherapeutic or the radiation that's going in there to rid that cancer from that society. And I really think that's why I enjoyed working in the special operations community so much, is because you knew every facet of your target. You knew every facet of the operational environment. You knew what you were doing and why you were doing it, and how that played into our strategic national strategy when you executed those missions.
I think that's awesome. And I'm going to take that even further, because that's like so deep. But that's like me now being a business owner for 13 years, right? When you are going into any type of scenario of business, or trying to accomplish anything in life, really, you're gonna have those fears, you're gonna have those doubts, you're gonna have those challenges. And if you really wanna be successful, you have to be laser focused on what the mission is. You have to know every player, you have to know everything. And so even though we're talking about it in a very different reality, which is the Special Missions Unit, I think that, you know, if we were to take that and probably overlay it into just the average Joe's life, their life, they're going to have special missions throughout their life. And I think that can really apply to, like, hey, and then also the ideas of, like you said, I love that, the cancers and the tumors, those fears, those doubts, those people who come into your life that try to hold you back and stop you from moving on, they're going to be the people who you have to, like, cut out. They're going to be the issues that you have to cut out. And so maybe not everybody can relate to having a rifle in their hand and having to go do some hard work, you know, for the beauty of our country or for our country, or maybe to help another person's country. But the reality is that they will have a moment in their life where they have to go and do some tough work, and they have to be laser focused on what they need to get done. And I love the way you put that, And I just wanted to take it and like kind of, and I hope it wasn't disrespectful, but I want to put it on. So if I have an average person listening to this right now, they'll be able to say like, that's a valuable thing for me to use in my world.
You're right, Hakeem. You have to shed your baggage. You know, you even as kids, you know, and you know, again, you know, my children. I have young children, and you know, they struggle. But we also have that in the workplace. We have people that have, you know, caustic relationships or toxic leaders in their workplace, and they need to shed that. You know, you don't. Your life is too short and too valuable to waste it on the ill manners or the adverse effects of being around toxicity and nastiness in your life. You know, you wouldn't hang around in a smoke-filled building and inhale the smoke fumes. You know, why do you stick around in a toxic work environment or an ugly relationship with a partner or a friend? You know, hunt the good stuff is something one of my mentors taught me a long time ago. You know, shed the baggage and hunt the good stuff.
Knowledge bombs. We tend to drop them a lot around here, and we appreciate your feedback and support for the information, interviews, and perspectives shared. Become a Patreon supporter for Survive University and get additional exclusive content not shared during the podcast. Patreon subscribers also get information on other Survive University products and projects before they're released to the public. So visit patreon.com/Survive University and join us as we continue on this journey to get ready, be ready, and stay ready like never before.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you answering that question, because I had my follow-up question based on his question in regards to you had aspirations to work in medicine, and you know, you took a side turn and ended up serving a long career in the United States Army only to come back to medicine. But now I see, based on that answer you provided, how you were able to come back full circle into the medical field and get a better understanding, because you had that laser focus, knew exactly what you wanted to do, dissected the problem and attacked it full on. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. So, Steve, I want to kind of end this session on a high note of understanding something real deep about you. And again, finishing, you know, segueing into that. So you were in Somalia. You had a mission to do there. And I know that, you know, you got injured. You got hurt. What was that like for you to be there? And for people who may be listening who don't know, you know, the movie that came out that was really popular that most people saw. And they played for me when I was in basic training, believe it or not, Black Hawk Down, really got me going and wanting to like continue on as a soldier. And
you got to watch movies and basic training. What happened to our military?
Well, now they got cell phones. So I feel like I was right on the cusp, right? So yeah, it definitely got my heart pumping, knowing, you know, hey, this is where we were going. But there's a real, we're fantasizing about it, and you lived the reality, which is no fantasy, which is no short thing. You know, people got hurt, people lost their lives, and there's nothing small about that. That's huge. That's really huge. And I would like for, you know, I would wonder if you would take us, if you'd be willing to take us into that moment of your perspective in that event.
Yeah, so I was pretty fortunate that I had been in the special operations community for a full decade at that point in time. I joined the Army in 1983. Somalia was in 1993. I'd been in several armed conflicts prior to that. I had the benefit of 5 years in the Rangers. Hard training, learning everything about soldiering from the ground soldier perspective I could possibly learn. And then as an operator, having gone through Delta selection and then the operator training course, having gone to war once previously with the unit in Just Cause in Panama, and understanding the operating tempo and the mechanisms by which the unit accomplished its missions, I was pretty fortunate that I was a fairly seasoned warfighter at the time. And I had also been to the Special Forces course. I had attended the Special Forces medic course and had become a Special Forces medic in the interim there. So I had some additional training that helped, again, OG on the medical lines, pointing me back toward that medical path. So it was, you know, in the days following my return home from Somalia and really analyzing what happened on the ground on 3 October in 1993, I don't think you could have thrown another contingency into that mess to make it any worse. A mission that went absolutely flawlessly. You know, we had captured or killed the folks that we were sent after. That part of the mission was done when my helicopter was shot down. My helicopter was shot down in a nasty part of town. Now, I was a sniper observer at that time. I was a trained sniper in the unit, and Delta snipers are also trained observers. So you learn how to, you know, collect intelligence either through the scope of your sniper rifle or on the street or stealthily. And I had performed several close target reconnaissance missions and area reconnaissance missions in and around the city of Mogadishu prior to 3 October, and certainly before all the other operations. The 3 October event was not our first operation in Mogadishu. It was our 13th mission. In the months leading up to 3 October, we had succeeded in accomplishing our mission time and time again. It wasn't until the 3 October, which unfortunately was a daytime raid, but we don't get to choose the timing of when our targets are going to show up or where they're going to show up, that my helicopter was shot down. And we landed in the nastiest part of Mogadishu, a place called the Bakar Market, which was essentially an unregulated arms market. So blocks away from our crash site was every weapon known to man and millions of rounds of ammunition for people to buy, warlords and freedom fighters to buy, sell, trade, steal, whatever. And that day, when, you know, the American forces were under attack, everybody and their brother flooded into the Bakar Market and got themselves the best new, you know, weapon they could find and lots of ammo. So we literally had the horde breathing down our neck at my crash site. There were only two of us conscious at the time. There were four of us conscious, the four in the back. Two pilots were killed. The two crew chief were unconscious. My three other teammates and I managed to get out of the aircraft. One of my teammates was immediately shot when he got out of the aircraft, fatally shot. And another one of our teammates dragged him over to an intersection where a Little Bird helicopter landed and picked them up and flew them back to the airfield. And that left my team leader and me at the crash site. My team leader had his nose shaved off his face in the crash. He was very disoriented, you know, severely concussed, but he was able to focus and shoot. So two of us fending off a fairly large horde until the search and rescue team, helicopter mounted relief force, was able to get to our position about 20 minutes after the crash. And then through the afternoon, the evening, and the night, the rest of the teams that were still on the ground from the target building several blocks away had fought their way to our crash site. So we had lots of help on my crash site, and I didn't realize I had broken my back in the crash, and I had shrapnel wounds all over my body, but I didn't really realize any of that had occurred. I was taking care of injured teammates. I was returning fire in lots of directions. Even after the search and rescue team got there, it was all hands on deck. I mean, it was a perimeter of nonstop firing all through the night, helicopters overhead trying to fend off the horde. When Mr. Durant's bird went down, the second aircraft was shot down. And unfortunately, at that point in time, the entire task force essentially, which was not very big. We're talking about a total of about 50 guys was at my crash site. So there was no one to go to Mr. Durant's crash site, which was well over a mile away, or about a mile away. But through, again, on the other side of the Bakar market, there was just no way we were going to get there. And of course, you know, history told the story on Mr. Durant and his crew and Randy Shugart and Gary Gordon, who fast roped down to his crash site and were ultimately killed. Both received the medals of honor for their participation in helping to rescue Mr. Durant, or at least save his hide. You know, it was 16 hours, I think, was the total time on the ground of literally nonstop fighting and contingency operations that you just couldn't have planned for. Like all my teammates, some of whom were very senior to me and some of whom were junior to me, but all very well trained, succeeded that night. And those of us that survived because of the training and the experience we had.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
All right, my preps, that's our episode for today. Thank you for listening and building your education and preparation with us. Please remember, real survival is not about what you can do as an individual, but when you empower those around you. Due to this, we ask that you share our podcast with friends, and we always appreciate a review. In addition, if you are looking for training in fields related to preparation, you can join one of our courses on surviveuniversity.com, where we teach you how to get ready, be ready, and stay ready. We are blessed today to have Mr. Steve DeLellis, and until next time.